relying on the brand names of her day to evoke setting, which is a technique many of our contemporary writers rely upon. The crime thrillers of George Pelicanos, for example, are very specifically set in Washington, D.C., and they are often set in a specific year. He evokes the time period by telling you what pop songs a character hears on the radio, and he often describes characters by telling us the brand names of their clothes. On the very first page of his novel, The Cut, for example, we're told that the main character, Spiro Lucas, is wearing Carhartt jeans and that he's taking notes in a black moleskin notebook. And throughout the novel, Pelicano skillfully combines real street and place names with brief bits of description. Here's a passage in which Spiro Lucas drives out of the city and then rides his bicycle to reconnoiter a suspicious location. He drove out to Hyattsville, Maryland, via Queens Chapel Road and Hamilton Street, and stopped in the lot of the 38th Street Park, through which ran the paved Northwest Branch Trail. He got onto his bike and pedaled southeast, staying in the middle gears, through open fields, past woods, across Rhode Island Avenue, and finally across alternate Route 1, navigating through fast vehicular traffic. He dipped down into Tanglewood Drive, entered the industrial district of Edmonston, and cruised at a steady place. All of these places are real. You can get on Google Street View, like I did when I read The Cut, and follow this route in every detail. The downside to a description like this is that if you don't know Hyattsville, Maryland, as well as Spiro Lucas or George Pelicanos do, your eye is likely to glide over these names. On the other hand, the author's use of these real place names bespeaks an authority and an intimacy with the setting that can be just as compelling to a reader as a more detailed description. In the context of a fast-paced thriller, this sort of description may even be more compelling. Even if you have never crossed Rhode Island Avenue through traffic, the passage evokes the confidence and expertise of Spiro Lucas. And, of course, there's that vast middle ground of narratives between those that use standalone set-piece descriptions and those that rely simply on place names. Let's go back to that breathless chase scene from Rosemary Sutcliffe's The Eagle of the Ninth and look at one particular sentence. On and on they hurtled, now skirting a reed-fringed upland pool, now swerving from a patch of bog luminously green in the fading light, uphill and down, through bronze tides of dying heather, startling here a flock of plover, there a stray curlew from the bents, and always behind them the hunt drawing nearer. Note how this long sentence starts with action, on and on they hurtled, and then launches into a series of adjective phrases with a participle at the end of each phrase, skirting, swerving, startling. Each one of these adjective phrases modifies the pronoun they at the beginning of the sentence. Now note how within each phrase, the participle is linked with a vivid feature of the landscape, skirting a reed-fringed upland pool, swerving round a patch of bog, startling a flock of plover. In this way, Sutcliffe skillfully evokes both motion and landscape, not only in the same paragraph, not only in the same sentence, but in the same phrase. Now, whether you choose to lavish your reader with a richly detailed technicolor description or just say that your detective walked into a Starbucks, remember that in most cases, how you use setting depends on the overall purpose of your narrative. Scene by scene, you want to lavish detailed descriptions on settings that recur or are especially important. But you only need a line or two to evoke settings that don't matter as much or that only turn up once. If a particular setting looms over the whole narrative, the way the majestic hotel looms over J.G. Farrell's novel Troubles, then you will constantly return to the setting as the story goes on, the way Farrell does. If you want to evoke the slow passage of travelers on foot across a landscape, then you will slow the narrative down for long descriptions of that landscape, the way Tolkien does in Lord of the Rings. But if you want to evoke an intense, energetic young private investigator speeding on his bicycle through a modern-day industrial park, you want to pick up the pace and just use place names, the way George Pelicanos does in The Cut. Now, here are a couple of different exercises you could try in order to explore the use of setting in a narrative. As I said earlier, one of the things you can do with setting is evoke character. So try describing the same setting from the point of view of two different characters who want different things. Take Sarah and Brad, for example, the unhappily married couple in my narrative from the first lecture. As you may recall, they're at a baseball game. So try describing the ballpark in two different ways. Show it first from Sarah's point of view, bearing in mind that she's about to ask for a divorce, and then show it from Brad's, bearing in mind that he has no idea what she's about to ask him. You could also explore just how important a particular setting is to a narrative by taking a famous novel or story and setting it in a radically different place or time from the original. As I said at the start of this lecture, people do this with Shakespeare all the time, and even with Jane Austen upon occasion. But you could rewrite a scene from, say, Huckleberry Finn that was set someplace other than the Mississippi. Or could one of the scenes from The Great Gatsby take place at any other place or time other than Long Island in the Jazz Age? Meanwhile, in the next lecture, I'll be talking about pacing in fiction, and we'll be looking at a variety of works, including Leo Tolstoy's novella The Death of Ivan Ilyich, Alice Munro's great short story The Beggar Maid, and Eleanor Catton's Booker Prize-winning novel The Luminaries, and John le Carré's classic spy thriller Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Lecture 19, Pacing in Scenes and Narratives.
Just as every piece of music has a beat, every narrative has a tempo. Some stories are fast-paced and breathless, some are slow and meditative. And there's that vast middle ground of narratives that are like symphonies, where the tempo varies throughout the work, depending on what the writer is trying to evoke at a particular moment. In fiction, we call this tempo pacing, and pacing is a rather slippery concept because it is so subjective. There are all sorts of different stories and all sorts of different readers. Readers who crave action and clever plot twists in every chapter are going to find George Eliot's Middlemarch glacially slow, while readers who want a story that lingers over the intimate details of a character's sensibility and her intricate relations with her family and her community are going to find Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon rather abrasively frenetic. Of course, there are many, many readers who, depending on their mood, enjoy both Middlemarch and The Maltese Falcon. However, since no one book can be all things to all readers, the trick for the writer is to find the right tempo or variety of tempos for her particular story. Pacing is also slippery because you have to account for it on at least two different levels. There is the tempo of the narrative considered as a whole. Then there's the tempo of the individual chapters and scenes, which may vary enormously. But both of these types of pacing are based on a sort of proportion or balance. Whether you're considering the overall pace of a 33-page short story like Alice Munro's The Beggar Maid, or the pace of a short individual scene in an enormous novel like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, you have to balance the amount of information you want to get across with the number of words or pages you have to do it in. You also have to factor in how much patience the reader is likely to have. In fact, there are three kinds of balance that you have to keep in mind, so let's take them one at a time. The first kind is the balance between the length of time a story or scene takes in the world of the narrative versus the amount of time it takes the reader to read it. On the whole, a long book that depicts a short period of time is probably going to be slower paced than a short book or a short story that depicts a long period of time. For example, James Joyce's Ulysses takes 265,000 words to depict about 20 hours in the life of its two main characters, Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom. On the other hand, Alice Munro's short story The Beggar Maid takes only 13,000 words to depict approximately 20 years in the life of Rose and Patrick, a couple who meet, marry, and then divorce. Both narratives provide intimate portraits of their two main characters, but I think it's safe to say that Munro's short story does it at a faster pace than Joyce's epic novel. But length all by itself is not a reliable measure of the pace of a narrative. You also have to consider the balance between the length of the story, its number of words or pages, and the number of incidents and the number of characters within it. You might even call this the density of the narrative. The Beggar Maid considers the rise and fall of a romantic relationship over 30 pages, and apart from a few minor characters along the way, it focuses almost entirely on Rose and Patrick. At the other extreme is Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, which totals more than 480,000 words. This is nearly twice as long as Ulysses. But instead of taking place over the course of a single day and telling the story of only two major characters, The Lord of the Rings takes place over 18 months and contains dozens of important characters and multiple interlinked plot lines. Most of these separate plot lines take place at the same time. This means that on any given day in the world of the book, several things might be happening at once, hundreds of miles apart. So even though it's much longer than Ulysses, The Lord of the Rings tells a more complicated, lengthy, and action-packed story. Therefore, it moves at a faster pace than Ulysses. And even though it's much, much longer than The Beggar Maid, The Lord of the Rings has many, many more characters and much more story to tell, not to mention many more scenes of adventure and violent action. As a result, even though The Beggar Maid is shorter and it takes place over a longer period of time, many of the scenes and chapters in The Lord of the Rings move at a faster pace than some of the scenes in The Beggar Maid. Which brings me to the third kind of balance between action and exposition, or what the writer and teacher Janet Burraway calls the balance between scene and summary. In most narratives, you switch back and forth between modes of storytelling. On the one hand, you usually dramatize the most important and interesting events as separate individual scenes. You give them the full complement of action, dialogue, and setting. You dramatize these scenes because you want the reader to remember these moments in particular. The fact that you lavish your full attention on these scenes reinforces the reader's impression that they are important. On the other hand, you often need to get across a good deal of important background or expository information, which, in itself, isn't necessarily very dramatic. Expository passages often stand outside the time sequence of the narrative. For example, you might pause the action to describe a setting or tell a character's backstory. Or you might simply summarize a long period of time in a few paragraphs in order to get the characters more quickly from one place to another or from one important moment in the story to the next one. For the rest of this lecture, I want to talk about how you can achieve these three kinds of balance. The balance between the passage of time in the story and the time it takes to read it, the balance between the length of the work and the number of incidents that occur in it, and the balance between action and exposition. To begin with, we'll look at how some writers have paced a whole narrative, and then we'll look at the pacing of an individual chapter or scene. Let's start with two relatively short narratives. One of them is Leo Tolstoy's novella, The Death of Ivan Ilyich, and the other is the story I've already mentioned, Alice Munro's The Beggar Maid. Each of these stories encompasses quite a bit of time within the relatively small number of pages. Tolstoy's novella tells the story of a Russian lawyer from his birth to his death at the age of 45 in 22,000 words, or about 50 pages. Alice Munro's story depicts about 20 years in the life of Rose and Patrick in 13,000 words, or about 30 pages. Each takes a different approach for reasons that will become apparent. The Death of Ivan Ilyich opens with a short chapter in which a group of Ivan Ilyich's fellow lawyers talk about his recent death, and then we never hear from these characters again. After that opening chapter, Tolstoy spends the next 11 pages summarizing the events of the first 44 years of Ivan Ilyich's life. This life is ordinary, uneventful, and even boring. The son of a civil servant, Ivan Ilyich becomes a civil servant himself, and his professional life is devoted to rising through the bureaucracy, while his personal life is devoted to social climbing, marriage, and fatherhood. Here's a typical passage that describes his marriage. Ivan Ilyich worked out an approach to married life. He asked no more of it than the conveniences which it was able to provide: dinner at home, a housewife, and a bed, and above all,
that propriety of external forms required by public opinion. For the rest, he looked for pleasure and good cheer, and when he found them, was very grateful. If, on the contrary, he met with antagonism and querulousness, he immediately retreated into his palisaded world of work and found his pleasure there. As I say, Ivan is not a very interesting guy. The overall effect of the story depends on Tolstoy convincing us of Ivan's ordinariness, and because the first 44 years of his life are the least dramatic part of the story, Tolstoy summarized them at a rapid clip. He tells us what we need to know and no more as quickly and as efficiently as possible. Then, about halfway through the novella, Ivan Ilyich falls off a ladder while he is hanging some curtains, and his injury leads to a mysterious illness that ends up killing him only 3 months later. Suddenly, this boring everyman's life has become dramatic. Having raced through the first 44 years of his life in 11 pages, Tolstoy slows the pace and spreads Ivan's last 3 months over 35 pages. There is a greater amount of detail and a sharper focus on his day-to-day moments as he weakens. Here's a scene from a month before his death, when he is being waited on by his wife and by his butler, whose name is Gerasim. His wife returned late that night. She came in on tiptoe, but he heard her, opened his eyes, and hastily shut them again. She wanted to send Gerasim out and sit with him herself. He opened his eyes and said, "No, go." "Are you suffering a lot?" "It doesn't matter. Take some opium." He consented and drank it. She went away. This is slower than anything in the first 11 pages, where nothing at all was dramatized in detail, but it's still pretty brisk and efficient. It's the bare bones of a scene, enough to plant a rudimentary image in the reader's mind, but not enough to linger over. But as the story reaches Ivan Ilyich's last day, the pace slows down even more. The last page and a half of the story is devoted to the final hour of Ivan's life. And so the balance between action and exposition in the death of Ivan Ilyich is pretty easy to diagram. Except for that opening chapter, it starts out as fast-paced exposition and then becomes slower and more dramatic as it goes on until the end, where it lingers over the very last moment in Ivan Ilyich's life. Let's compare this with what happens in The Beggar Maid. This story goes for 33 pages, and the first 30 pages depict only the first year of the relationship between its two main characters. In these pages, we watch Patrick, a graduate student, fall in love with Rose, who is an undergraduate at the same Canadian university. They have a complicated and rather prickly courtship. Patrick is embarrassed by his rich family in Vancouver, while Rose is embarrassed by her working-class mother in a small town in Ontario. Each one grapples with his or her own emotions, and together they fumble at sex. You can already see how the pacing of this story is different from that of the death of Ivan Ilyich. The majority of the story takes place over 8 months or so. Whereas Tolstoy puts all the exposition in at once at the beginning, Monroe shifts effortlessly back and forth between vividly dramatized moments and sharp passages of exposition. And she does this paragraph by paragraph, and sometimes sentence by sentence, all the way through the story. Here's an example. The Dr. Henshaw in this excerpt is a professor who is also Rose's landlady. There was something edgy, jumpy, disconcerting about Patrick. His voice would break under stress. With her, it seemed he was always under stress. He knocked dishes and cups off tables, spilled drinks and bowls of peanuts like a comedian. He was not a comedian. Nothing could be further from his intentions. He came from British Columbia. His family was rich. He arrived early to pick Rose up when they were going to the movies. He wouldn't knock. He knew he was early. He sat on the top step outside of Dr. Henshaw's door. This was in the winter. It was dark out. But there was a little coach lamp beside the door. "Oh, Rose, come and look," called Dr. Henshaw in her soft, amused voice, and they looked down together from the dark window of the study. "The poor young man," said Dr. Henshaw tenderly. Note how quickly and seamlessly this passage moves from an abstract, expository description of Patrick, that he is edgy, jumping, disconcerting, and that his family in British Columbia is rich,
to a specific dramatized moment that evokes just how jumpy and edgy he is by showing us that he's too nervous to knock on Rose's door. These two modes of narrative sit adjacent to each other on the page. The story doesn't segregate the exposition from the action, but weaves them together throughout. At the center of The Beggar Maid is a long, fully dramatized scene in which Rose breaks up with Patrick. This is then followed by a brief, more expository scene in which she changes her mind and they end up getting married. Then, in the last three pages of the story, Monroe summarizes Rose and Patrick's unhappy 10-year marriage in five paragraphs before giving us a final scene 9 years after their divorce. In this brief, wordless, devastating encounter, they see each other in the airport in Toronto, and Rose is shocked when Patrick makes a hateful face at her, a timed explosion of disgust and loathing. Both the pacing and the balance between action and exposition in each of these stories reflect the different intents of their authors. Tolstoy wants to show us that most of Ivan Ilyich's life has been shallow and selfish, so he races through the first 44 years in order to linger on his last moments, when Ivan Ilyich's suffering allows him to feel compassion for his wife and son. In order to evoke this emotional journey, the novella needs to start at a rapid pace with very little detail and then slow down as it goes. This pace reflects Ivan Ilyich's own moral and spiritual education. In The Beggar Maid, however, Monroe is more like a lawyer building a case. In order to prepare for that focused moment of loathing on the last page, she needs to show us in slow, patient, dramatic detail why Patrick and Rose should never have married in the first place and why they did anyway. Having done that, she can then fast forward through the marriage itself and through the 9 years after it in order to dramatize their final encounter. The nature of each story dictates the pace at which it is told. Now let's take a look at two much longer narratives, Eleanor Catton's Booker Prize-winning novel, The Luminaries, and Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. Both of these novels are long, with complicated plots and a large cast of characters. The Luminaries clocks in at over 800 pages, while The Lord of the Rings is over 1,000 pages. But because they are different types of stories, and because the intents of their authors are different, they are paced very differently. The Luminaries is a pastiche of such 19th-century potboilers as Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone. It's set during a gold rush on the west coast of New Zealand during the 1860s, and it has a complicated plot involving secrets, conspiracies, and betrayals. What's interesting about the telling of this long and complex story, however, is that Catton chooses not to dramatize many of the most striking scenes, including a shipwreck and a possible murder. Instead, she structures the novel as a series of long conversations between various combinations of her large and diverse cast of characters. During these conversations, the buried plot of the novel is slowly revealed as the characters confide in, threaten, and negotiate with each other. There are a few passages of action and scene setting, and in nearly every chapter, Catton pauses the conversation to tell us something about the history or psychology of one or more of her characters. But on the whole, the novel moves at a steady and unvarying pace throughout, as the reader eavesdrops on these conversations in more or less real time. In the end, the novel is more about the nature of storytelling itself than it is about the actual working out of the mystery. In other words, it's about how people construct reality out of the stories they tell each other. On the other hand, The Lord of the Rings is also full of scenes in which the characters tell each other's stories, not to mention many scenes of negotiation, debate, and outright aggression, but the intent of The Lord of the Rings is different. Tolkien was a veteran of World War I, and he wrote much of The Lord of the Rings during World War II. Partly because of these experiences, the novel is a narrative about the end of one world and the dawn of a new one. It is also about the effect of a catastrophic war on both individuals and whole races of people. Because he wishes to immerse us in this epic tale, Tolkien varies the pace throughout the book. In order to let us know which scenes are important and which passages are mere background or scene setting, He slows down and dramatizes the most important moments and merely summarizes the less important ones. There are long passages of exposition. In some cases, whole chapters do nothing but tell backstory. But for the most part, Tolkien's story regularly shifts between action and exposition as his characters move across the vast landscape of Middle-earth. For example, early in the novel, as Frodo and his companions are leaving the village of Bree on their way to Rivendell, not to get too geeky on you, Tolkien devotes only about a page to the first 5 days of their trip. However, later, when Frodo and his companions enter the mines of Moria to pass under the Misty Mountains, Tolkien devotes 2 entire chapters to the 2.5 days they spend underground. It's easy to see why he devotes more time to the second sequence than he does to the first. In the first instance, nothing terribly important happens during those 5 days, but Tolkien has to get his characters from one place to another. So, he tells us just enough to let us know that time has passed and what sort of landscape they move through. In the second instance, a great deal happens in the mines of Moria that is essential to the plot, not the least of which are a couple of exciting fight scenes and the apparent death of a major character. So Tolkien slows down and dramatizes much more of it. He gives us action and dialogue, as well as a vivid and detailed evocation of the setting. Tolkien also slows down the pace for his great set-piece action scenes, such as the Battle of Helm's Deep and the Battle of Pelennor Fields. He does this because they are important to the story, but he also slows down these scenes because they are inherently thrilling. Unlike Catton, whose intent is more postmodern and cerebral, Tolkien's intent is to allow the reader to visit Middle-earth and participate in its history. And so he skillfully varies the pace, alternating thrilling or dramatic scenes with passages of exposition or backstory. The purpose of the expository scenes is partly to give the reader a breather and partly to prepare us for what comes next. Our discussion of how Tolkien paces The Lord of the Rings points the way to our next discussion about how to pace individual scenes. As my remarks about Tolkien suggest, how a scene is paced depends partly on its function in the narrative as a whole and on the author's intent. When you're thinking about the pacing of a scene, you need to ask yourself, is the scene important or not? Is it inherently dramatic or not? Let's look at several different types of scene and talk about the tempo their authors choose for them. And bear in mind that different writers with different intents may treat the same sort of scene completely differently. Scenes which introduce new characters to a narrative tend to be played out at a slow pace in real time. This is also true of scenes of domestic life that are intended to show the characters at home in a setting that is familiar to them. A couple of lectures ago, when I was talking about point of view, I talked about a scene that does both, namely chapter 11 of George Eliot's Middlemarch. The first half of the chapter is pure exposition, introducing us to Lydgate, a handsome doctor who is new to the community. The second half of the chapter is fully dramatized, introducing us to two major characters, Fred and Rosamund Vincey, who are brother and sister, and a minor character, their mother. This second scene is about 2,200 words long. Late one morning, Mrs. Vincey and Rosamund are working at embroidery in the dining room, and Fred comes down late for breakfast. The scene is 90% dialogue, and in the bantering exchanges between Fred and Rosamund, the irritability and competitiveness of young adult siblings is vividly evoked, as is their mother's patient attempt to mediate. In this excerpt, Fred, an arrogant young college student, bickers with his sister over their mother's use of lower-class slang. "Are you beginning to dislike slang, then?" said Rosamund with mild gravity. "Only the wrong sort. All choice of words is slang. It marks a class." "There is correct English. That is not slang." "I beg your pardon. Correct English is the slang of prigs who write history and essays. And the strongest slang of all is the slang of poets." "You will say anything, Fred, to gain your point." "Well, tell me whether it is slang or poetry to call an ox a leg-plater." "Of course, you can call it poetry if you like." "Aha, Miss Rosie, you don't know Homer from slang. I shall invent a new game. I shall write bits of slang and poetry on slips and give them to you to separate." "Dear me, how amusing it is to hear young people talk," said Mrs. Vincey,
with cheerful admiration. Notice how their mother chimes in at the end to smooth things over. In its perceptiveness and subtle shifts of mood, not to mention the immediate familiarity we feel with Fred and Rosamund, it's a nearly perfect scene, and it would have played out in real time at the same pace as it takes to read it out loud. On the other hand, you can play intensely dramatic or violent scenes either fast or slow, depending on your intent. For example, at the end of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, Captain Ahab and the crew of his ship chase the great white whale Moby Dick for 3 days. This chase takes place over the course of 3 thrilling chapters, stretching out the suspense for 40 pages. Much of the previous 800 pages, of course, have been dedicated to Ahab's obsession with killing Moby Dick, who severed Ahab's leg in an earlier encounter. When Ahab's whaling boat is at last within harpooning distance of the whale, Melville slows the narrative down to let Ahab make one last crazy speech. "To the last I grapple with thee, from hell's heart I stab at thee, for hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee." But then, in the very final moment of the last encounter between Ahab and Moby Dick, Ahab's death happens in an instant. The harpoon was darted, the stricken whale flew forward. With igniting velocity, the line ran through the groove, ran foul. Ahab stooped to clear it. He did clear it. But the flying turn caught him round the neck, and voicelessly as Turkish mutes bowstring their victim, he was shot out of the boat ere the crew knew he was gone. Next instant, the heavy eye splice in the rope's final end flew out of the stark empty tub, knocked down an oarsman, and smiting the sea, disappeared in its depths. After 800 pages of listening to Ahab rant about Moby Dick, readers are usually shocked when Moby Dick kills him in a heartbeat, jerking him by the neck out of the boat. There's no 19th century melodrama about Ahab's death. It's shocking and pointless, and after the last 3 chapters of pursuit and one last flowery rant, it's told in only 88 words. It's a dazzling example of how a sudden shift in pacing can open the abyss at the reader's feet. Alternately, you may want to show the skill of your hero at physical combat, and so you might slow down the action, the same way an Asian martial arts picture shows certain spectacular moves in slow motion to emphasize the skill of the performers. Here's Spiro Lucas, the detective in George Pelicanos' detective novel The Cut, being attacked at night in a parking lot by an assassin. They moved at the same time. The man swung the knife, and Lucas stepped out of its arc and back. The man swung again. His reach was not sufficient, and Lucas knew he would have to come in. The man flipped the knife, switching it to a down grip, and he brought it across from his right shoulder as if he were swinging a bat. He caught only air. He brought the blade back from the other direction and swung with a grunt, and it took him too far. Lucas stepped to the side and then came in quickly, grabbed the man's wrist, and struck a hammer blow to the knife arm's elbow. The man's hand opened like a stunned flower, sending the knife skittering across the asphalt. Lucas pushed him away. This is thrilling stuff, and it goes on for another 4 paragraphs before Spiro finally kills the guy with his bare hands. On the one hand, this certainly looks fast-paced because a lot happens in the paragraph in only 129 words. But in real time, the fight would probably take less than a minute. And if you put that against the time and concentration it takes for the reader to slow down and follow every blow and knife thrust, you discover that Pelicanos actually slows the pace of his narrative here. And by doing so, he shows us just how skillful Spiro Lucas can be in hand-to-hand combat. You can also slow the pace of a scene in order to wring the last bit of suspense or mystery out of it. Let's take John le Carré's classic spy novel, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, as an example. In Tinker Tailor, the aging spy George Smiley has been assigned to discover the identity of a Soviet mole, or double agent, who's been working at the highest level of British intelligence for 30 years. The book's pace varies throughout, shifting between long dialogue scenes, extended flashbacks, and long, detailed expository passages. In the book's climactic scene, Smiley is hiding with a gun in the kitchen of a safe house. He has lured the double agent, whom he has nicknamed Gerald, and Gerald's Soviet handler, to the safe house in order to catch them red-handed. As he waits,
Smiley knows that the next voice he hears will tell him which one of his trusted friends and colleagues is a traitor. This is the climax of the novel, the secret both Smiley and the reader have been working to learn. In order to heighten the drama and the suspense, Le Carré slows the narrative down. He tells us every detail. He makes us sweat alongside Smiley in the kitchen. He heard the tread of a pair of feet on the gravel, brisk and vigorous. They stopped. "It's the wrong door," Smiley thought absurdly. "Go away." He had the gun in his hand. He had dropped the catch. Still he listened, heard nothing. "You're suspicious, Gerald," he thought. "You're an old mole. You can sniff there's something wrong." "Millie," he thought. "Millie has taken away the milk bottles, put up a warning, headed him off. Millie spoilt the kill." Then he heard the latch turn, one turn, two. "It's a Bantam lock," he remembered. "My God, we must keep Bantam in business." Of course, the mole had been patting his pockets, looking for his key. A nervous man would have had it in his hand already, would have been clutching it, cosseting it in his pocket all the way in the taxi, but not the mole. The mole might be worried, but he was not nervous. Now, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is one of the best popular novels ever written, but in this passage, Le Carré is writing stream of consciousness with nearly the intensity and density of the detail of Virginia Woolf. Not only are we in the kitchen with Smiley, clutching a pistol, we are inside his head, following his every anxious thought. Again, as with the fight scene in the Pelicanos novel, the events in this paragraph, an unseen man coming to the door and patting his pockets for the key, and Smiley's racing thoughts, would take only a few seconds in real time. But Le Carré almost cruelly slows it down. He makes us wait for the big reveal. These, of course, are only a few rather obvious examples of how the pacing of a scene can heighten its emotional effect. There are many other fruitful examples I don't have time to get into. Scott Spencer's epic 40-page sex scene in his novel Endless Love. The ending of James Joyce's The Dead, in which Gabriel Conroy's epiphany about his marriage and his life is evoked over several pages. And the first conversation between Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice, which Jane Austen paces so that it reads like gladiatorial combat. I urge you to check these out on your own. In the meantime, you can experiment with pacing by trying this simple exercise. Take an incident from something you've written and try writing it several different ways, as a summary, as a close third-person narrative, or as a long dialogue scene, and take note how the difference in pace changes the effect. Then compare the results and see which one best serves the intent of the narrative you've written. The result may surprise you. This exercise will also serve as a good transition for my next lecture, when I'll be talking about constructing scenes, and we'll look at some examples from Alice Munro, Eleanor Catton, and yours truly.
Lecture 20, Building Scenes.
Writers approach the day-to-day process of composition in many different ways. They differ in their aesthetic approach, they differ in temperament, they differ in willpower and discipline. And of course, what approach you take each day depends on the balance between the overall shape of your narrative and the needs of the particular passage you're working on. Writers also differ on what each one considers to be the fundamental unit of writing fiction. Some writers conceptualize the whole narrative in terms of plot points. Some writers think in terms of character arcs. Some think in terms of the larger ideas they want to get across, and so on. Some writers focus mainly on crafting elegant sentences. In a famous interview in the Paris Review, the Russian novelist Vladimir Nabokov claimed to write novels the way someone might fill in a crossword puzzle. He paid no particular attention to chronology, at least to begin with. Instead, he wrote a few sentences at a time on index cards and then assembled the cards later into a narrative. But no matter how you approach the day-to-day process, every writer, even Nabokov, is eventually faced with the prospect of making the whole thing hang together. We'll talk about that in our next two lectures, when we look at how the processes of composition and revision go hand in hand. But right now, I want to talk about what a writer does each day. And for me, that means creating individual scenes. What exactly do I mean by a scene? As I had discussed at length in my previous lectures about evocation and pacing, most narratives are divided between passages of exposition, in which the author summarizes the information the reader needs to know, and fully dramatized passages, which include action, dialogue, and setting. It's these dramatized passages that I'll be talking about, even though some of what I'll say applies to expository passages as well. In his book, The Art of Fiction, John Gardner defines a scene as everything that is included in an unbroken flow of action from one incident in time to another. According to Gardner, this unbroken flow of action can include movement through space from one place to another, as long as there isn't a big jump in time. In other words, a scene shows more or less everything that happens to a character, or between two or more characters, during a discrete span of time. In order to qualify as a scene in this definition, there can't be any interruptions in the flow of that time, except for flashbacks or brief passages of exposition. Of course, there are many different types of scene. For example, there are brief scenes that last only a few sentences and feature only a few characters in a narrowly defined setting, such as the opening scene of Flannery O'Connor's short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find. On a larger scale, there are epic scenes that go on for many pages and show many characters doing many things in a huge setting, such as the vast battle scenes in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. There are scenes that are merely transitional. There are scenes that are pivotal moments in the plot. There are scenes where nothing happens but the thoughts of a single character. There are scenes where all the characters do is talk to each other, and there are scenes which are full of violent, thrilling action. There are also scenes within scenes, which I'll talk about later in this lecture. As I said in my lecture on pacing, it is usually pretty easy to decide what you should make into a scene as opposed to what you should reveal through exposition. In other words, what you choose to dramatize rather than summarize. As I also said last time, you usually want to dramatize the most important or interesting parts of the story and rely on exposition to get across the necessary but less interesting information. If you simply want the reader to know a bit of backstory, that's exposition. But if you want to have the reader experience something along with the characters, that's a scene. Way back in my lecture about evocation, I said that scenes in which the readers vicariously participate are much more vivid and memorable than passages in which they are simply told something. If you want the reader to remember something, have it happen right in front of her. A good example of this distinction comes from Alice Munro's story, The Beggar Maid, which, as you may recall, is about the courtship, marriage, and eventual divorce of two young Canadians, Rose and Patrick. As you may also recall, the story takes 30 pages to cover the first 8 months of their relationship and then summarizes their subsequent marriage, divorce, and final meeting in the last 3 pages of the story. For most of the story's first 25 pages, Munro shifts effortlessly between exposition and little bits of drama, often within the same paragraph. In fact, most of the dramatized bits only go on for a paragraph or two. At the end of those first 25 pages, however, Munro gives us a fully dramatized scene. It's the scene in which Rose shows up at Patrick's room early in the morning and tells him she doesn't want to marry him. This scene goes on for 3.5 pages, which is a lot of real estate in a 33-page story. Munro chooses to give this scene more time than any other scene in the story because it is the most dramatic moment in Rose and Patrick's relationship, showing them at their most raw and intimate. It also sets up the startling reversal in the next, much shorter scene, when Rose's resolve weakens and she decides to marry him after all, leading both herself and Patrick into years of misery. In other words, the scene in which Rose breaks up with Patrick is the heart of the story. This is why Munro lets this moment play out in real time in front of the reader. Without it, the rest of the story simply wouldn't have the same impact. This particular scene also illustrates another important point about scenes in general. An individual scene needs to do at least 2 things at the same time. It needs to advance the larger narrative, and it needs to be interesting in its own right. In other words, a writer needs to balance the scene's position in the whole story with its own inherent drama. And one way to achieve this balance is to remember that a scene should be no longer than it needs to be in order to serve its purpose within the story as a whole. Please note that I'm not saying that a scene should necessarily be short, efficient, and economical, but rather that no individual scene should go on so long that a reader begins to wonder why she's still reading it. The length of a scene depends on the narrative as a whole, as well as the inherent interest of the individual scene. But these two balanced intentions can vary enormously from one narrative to another. Take George Pelecanos' hard-boiled detective novel, The Cut, for example. This is a fast-paced narrative written with efficiency and economy. Even so, its young detective, Spiro Lucas, occasionally takes time out from the case he's working on to have an erotic interlude with a young woman. In fact, over the course of the book, he strings along two different women because he's that kind of guy. These brief scenes about his love life add complexity to the character, and they serve to tell us something we wouldn't otherwise know about Spiro. But because they aren't central to the story, they tend to be much shorter and more expository than the scenes that actually advance the investigation. Pelecanos properly devotes more space and detail and dramatic energy to those scenes in which Spiro is interviewing a witness or stalking a suspect. On the other hand, in a more expansive, less plot-driven narrative such as Ulysses or Moby Dick, a scene can go on for pages simply because it is inherently interesting. These novels are more interesting for the quality of their language, the richness of the world being evoked, or the inherent interest of the subject matter than they are for the story. In Moby Dick, Herman Melville devotes long passages and even whole chapters to describing the work of a whaling vessel, the natural history of whales, and other topics that don't advance the plot. However, these scenes still advance the overall purpose of the book. They evoke an entire way of life in as much detail as possible, but they aren't necessarily concerned with advancing a story. And with some books, the point of the novel isn't the plot at all, but the individual scenes that make up the plot. With your indulgence, I'll offer up one of my own novels, The Lecturer's Tale, as an example. Now, this book does have a plot. It's about a failing academic named Nelson, who uses a supernatural power to rise through the English department of a fictional Midwestern university. But the purpose of the book wasn't necessarily to tell a story, but to allow me to make fun of the worst excesses of modern literary theory. As I was writing it, I realized that the book was basically a series of satirical set pieces, each one of which was more over the top than the one before. These set pieces weren't entirely self-contained, since each one did push my silly plot a little further along. But each chapter or scene was mainly intended to be amusing for its own sake. It became clear to me early on that the point of the plot was to set up the scenes, not the other way around. One of the plot points in The Lecturer's Tale is the fact that Nelson's department has a job opening. And even though Nelson isn't qualified for the position, he decides to sabotage the three main candidates. So in a chapter entitled The Three Stooges, Nelson uses his supernatural power to get each candidate to embarrass him or herself. The chapter is made up of three major scenes, and in each scene, one of the job candidates self-destructs in public. The second scene, for example, features a charismatic Englishman who studies popular culture. And I had him deliver a lecture in which he deconstructs an Elvis Presley movie called Viva Vietnam. When somebody in the audience of the lecture points out that such a movie never existed, I had the Englishman argue that it didn't matter whether the movie existed or not. What mattered was his analysis. The satirical target of this scene was academics who put literary criticism above actual works of art, but part of my incentive for writing it was simply to amuse myself and, I hope, the reader. And so, it became an extended comic riff on a fake Elvis Presley movie set in Vietnam, complete with fake Elvis Presley song titles like Dien Bien Phu, You Broke My Heart of Darkness, and The Moonlight, The Minefield, and You. I easily could have shown the Englishman's self-destruction in a much shorter scene, but it wouldn't have been as much fun. My point here is that how long a scene goes on, and whether it should be included at all, does not depend on the plot necessarily, but on the intent of the narrative as a whole. A plot-driven crime novel like The Cut needs to move through the water like a shark. If it slows down, it dies. Trying to squeeze in a long chapter about the history of detective work or Spiro Lucas's history with women would throw the whole novel out of whack. On the other hand, The Lecturer's Tale has a different metabolism than a thriller. You're not meant to race through it the way you read a novel like The Cut. You're meant to enjoy each scene as it comes. As a result, the scenes in that book are longer and slower than the scenes in The Cut. The scenes in each book have a different pace and structure because the intent of each book is different. Transitioning into and out of a scene is something that vexes some writers, even experienced ones. These transitions can vary enormously, depending on the intent of the scene, its length, its importance in the narrative, and so on. For example, scenes that take place early in the narrative are going to need more of a setup on the whole than scenes that appear later. When you're introducing characters, situations, or settings for the first time, you need to spend more time describing them than you do later on, when the reader already knows who the character is or what the setting looks like. You can take your time in these scenes. You can describe the setting and the character in some detail and let the characters talk a bit more digressively than they might in later scenes. For example, in the very first paragraph of The Maltese Falcon, Dashiell Hammett gives us a detailed physical description of his detective, Sam Spade. You may recall that Spade is described as looking like a blonde Satan. Hammett provides this detailed and evocative description first thing, so that later on, he can just start a scene with Spade's name or some action or gesture without having to tell us all over again what he looks like. The same goes for Spade's office. Having described it once, Hammett doesn't need to do it again, unless some particular feature of the setting needs to be pointed out for a particular purpose in that particular scene. For example, if Hammett wants to make it clear that a scene is happening in Spade's office at sunset, he might start the scene by saying something like, "The last light of the sun slanted through the slats of the blinds." There's no need for him to describe everything in the office again. Also, short scenes need less of an introduction than longer, more dramatic scenes. You can signal the start of a new scene with something as simple as a space break in the text, or, if time has passed since the last section, with a simple phrase like "the next day" or "a few hours later." On the other hand, if the scene is going to be longer or more important or more dramatic, you might want to make more of a fuss at the start. Alice Munro begins that significant scene in The Beggar Maid, the one in which Rose breaks up with Patrick, with a description of Rose's walk from her room to Patrick's apartment. She woke up early, got up, and dressed, and let herself out the side door of Dr. Henshaw's garage. It was too early for the buses to be running. She walked through the city to Patrick's apartment. She walked across the park. Around the South African War Memorial, a pair of greyhounds were leaping and playing, an old woman standing by holding their leashes. The sun was just up, shining on their pale hides. The grass was wet. Daffodils and narcissus were in bloom. As I said earlier, most of the story before this point moves at a brisk pace. This paragraph immediately slows down the narrative and lets us know that something important is about to happen. It provides a bumper between the fast-paced mixture of exposition and miniature scenes that came immediately before it and the slower and more dramatic scene that's about to start. After that little prologue, Munro lets the encounter between Rose and Patrick play out before the reader in more or less real time. But then she ends the scene abruptly and dramatically, befitting the emotionally turbulent nature of the encounter, as Rose storms out of Patrick's apartment. "I don't want to see you, ever," she said viciously. But at the door she turned and said in a normal and regretful voice, "Goodbye." After easing us into the scene and letting it play out in front of the reader, Munro then cuts the scene off as sharply as Rose cuts off her relationship with Patrick. It's a skillful mimetic effect, evoking the same shock in the reader that both Rose and Patrick must feel at that moment. Another way to transition into a scene is to begin it in medias res, which, as I've mentioned in an earlier lecture, is a Latin expression that means in the middle of things. This is one of the oldest and most reliable tricks in a fiction writer's repertoire, namely starting a scene in the middle of the action, or at least after the action of the scene is already underway. The chief advantage of entering a scene already in progress is that it adds energy and urgency to the narrative. It also engages the reader on a deeper level by forcing him to sit up and pay attention to what's going on. It's as if he's walked into a lively party full of interesting people that started an hour before he got there. In fact, this is exactly what happens in the opening sequence of Eleanor Catton's epic historical mystery, The Luminaries. In her bravura opening chapter, Catton introduces us to a character named Walter Moody, who has just arrived at a remote gold rush community on the west coast of New Zealand in 1866. In the opening pages of the book, he finds himself in a hotel lounge with 12 other men. He has never met any of these men before, but they proceed to tell him a long, complicated story about a suspicious death, a suicide attempt, and the discovery of a fortune in gold, all of which happened weeks before Moody even showed up. By throwing both Moody and the reader into the deep end of the pool, Catton risks making the reader feel overwhelmed the way Moody does himself at first. But she constructs that opening scene so energetically and with such attention to detail that she hooks us into the mystery that isn't even fully explained until 800 pages later. Now, when it comes to making a transition from one scene to another, usually you can accomplish it without any fuss. Here's another example from The Beggar Maid. This is a brief passage that starts as exposition and shifts suddenly into a little bit of drama. It comes during a sequence where Patrick has taken Rose back to British Columbia to meet his family. The sisters Joan and Marion were younger than Patrick, older than Rose. Unlike Patrick, they showed no nervousness, no cracks in self-satisfaction. At an earlier meal, they had questioned Rose. Do you ride? No. Do you sail? No. Play tennis? Play golf? Play badminton? No, no, no. Here, two simple expository sentences about Patrick's sisters lead immediately, with hardly any transition, into a brief scene in which we can hear, in only 17 words, Joan and Marion's snobbery and Rose's embarrassment. Transitioning out of a scene is perhaps a little less vexing than transitioning into one. Again, it depends on the scene's purpose and the narrative as a whole, but in general, you can round off a scene more briskly than you can start one. Once the main purpose of the scene is played out, the new character has been sufficiently introduced, the plot point has been made, you usually want to wrap it up as quickly as possible, but without coming across like a host pushing his guests out the door. For some kinds of narrative, you might end a scene with a sort of punchline, a witticism from the character, or even a sudden revelation. But even with narratives that aren't driven by plot, you don't want to linger over the scene after its purpose has been fulfilled. As I said earlier, there can also be transitions within a scene, such as when a writer pauses to provide some exposition or segues into a flashback. Eleanor Catton's The Luminaries is made up mostly of long dramatized scenes, but because the plot is so complicated, she often has to pause the action to introduce an extended flashback that lasts for many pages before returning to the original scene. Because The Luminaries is written in the style of a 19th century novel, sometimes Catton directly addresses the reader in a formal manner that calls attention to the transition itself. We shall therefore intervene and render Suk Yong Sheng's story in a way that is accurate to the events he wished to disclose, rather than to the style of his narration. At other times, she slips effortlessly from drama to exposition with hardly any transition at all. The entire passage is too long to quote here, but here are the beginning and the end of an important piece of exposition about Walter Moody, which comes in the middle of a conversation
Moody is having with a character named Gascoigne. The two men are discussing a prostitute named Anna, who has been wearing another woman's clothes for reasons that are too complicated for me to explain. Here's how the scene transitions from drama to exposition. "Mr. Gascoigne," Moody said, holding up his hand, "despite my youth,